My next guest is Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree, who currently offers 68 ETFs in the U.S., about $45 billion invested. And I would say there are few better to discuss the global financial markets than Jeremy, who is now on the line with me from Philadelphia. Jeremy, always great connecting. Thanks for taking the time.
Nate, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Well, first, how's everything been going over at WisdomTree? I know you have a Bitcoin ETF filing, which we're not going to discuss this week. Hopefully we can at some point later this year, but you have that. I saw your change in the name on the 9060 U.S. Balance Fund to the U.S. Efficient Core Fund. That's ticker NTSX, which interesting there is that ETF has grown to about $500 million in assets. It's really been a nice success story. You launched the cybersecurity ETF earlier this year. You have the cloud computing ETF, which has done really well. A China X state-owned enterprises ETF. Just give us a quick update on everything going on at WisdomTree.
That's like a greatest hits of WisdomTree right there, Nate. I love it. I think for people who are interested, I mean, certainly we can't talk about funds and filing, but we have been writing about digital assets from a pure education perspective, sharing a lot in common with you on trying to educate on the space. And so if you go to our blog, wisdomtree.com, you'll see we've been writing about digital assets more and more, trying to talk about what we think about Bitcoin generally, what are the use cases, why think about it, increasingly on Ether as well. My personal view is you think about Bitcoin as, and you had Stan Druckenmiller talking about the Fed today on CNBC and an op-ed in Wall Street Journal talking about what he thinks are insane policies from the Fed, sort of blowing asset bubbles. And Bitcoin has become the new generation's digital gold. In a lot of ways, that's the narrative that has resonated. And we see that being this value asset in sort of fixed supply in a money printing world is one of the things that's resonating. And Ether is like the technology for creativity, and it's only limited by the developers operating that ecosystem. So we're excited about digital assets. We're doing a lot in the space. We talked about our investment into currency, which we are a large minority investor in, and all the things that we're planning to do in the tokenization world with the currencies, infrastructure and technology. So I definitely encourage people to go learn more about what we're planning there. In terms of other things, the efficient core you mentioned, we are excited. We're planning to expand more in that family. Product development, we had, I think one of our themes for the last few years was divest to reinvest, and we closed a number of funds. We got leaner, and we're sort of reinvesting those savings now and planning more aggressive expansion. And also the efficient core family is one that's resonated as an anchor to portfolios. We're like unique in the market today. No one else is doing this really in ETFs today, which is not easy to find, that white space. But it's sort of combining equities and bonds in a diversified portfolio with bond futures on top of equities. And we're planning to do that for international and emerging markets quite soon to follow up on the U.S. But we see that being a nice anchor to portfolios. And as you said, thematics are one of the reasons ETFs were built for. I mean, ETFs were built to get unique baskets together, and we've got really interesting partners with Bessemer Venture Partners on the cloud computing, which globally has raised close to $2 billion with the U.S. and Europe launching together in September of 2019. And we've had a lot of success. I hope to build on that success in the future. And you see us doing other interesting partners like Team 8 with Cyber, and you had the Colonial Gas Pipeline. You're seeing gas shortages. I don't know if you saw these stories on North Carolina, people running out of gas from this cyber breach in the Colonial Pipeline. And I think that's one where you should stay very closely tuned to our content channels. We're going to bring some unique insights on what's happening with these cyber breaches and what are the companies that can help protect, what are these companies doing. It's a very limited basket. We think that's going to also expand in the future, but cyber is a really interesting part of it, but also just generally of our thematics. We think there's going to be more to do with cutting-edge partners for these technology themes.
Jeremy, you mentioned product development, and as I look back on the launches from WisdomTree over the past several years, you've been very meticulous in launching new products. I show only 10 new ETFs over the past 4 years, which really isn't a lot for an issuer of your size. Can you talk just a little bit more about WisdomTree's approach to product development and new ETFs?
Sure. I mean, we started off, 15, this is going to be our 15-year anniversary. I mean, it's hard to believe, and I've been there from the very beginning to see how we developed. And we were the first firm to do what we called affiliated indexing, self-indexing. You'd have most firms go to, an iShares and Vanguard would go to MSCI and S&P and Russell. And we had developed our own proprietary indexes. And we were the first to do that. We helped set the roadmap and got through the SEC for what do the affiliate indexing rules look like. Increasingly, we've gone, now you have the ability to do active ETFs. You even have the ability to do index committee-based ETFs. And one of the things when we first had the affiliated indexing relief, we couldn't have an index committee. We actually now are about to launch our first index committee approach in the biology space, biology revolution space. And, I think it's just another way of doing active in some ways. I mean, you have more flexibility with the committee. And, I think part of we have as capabilities across the asset class spectrum from equities, bonds, alternatives. We repurposed a commodity fund this year, which is doing incredibly well. It's sort of a more diversified exposure with an active approach to commodities, doing something similar in managed futures. I think you always try to find unique areas, unique insights on the market. But increasingly, I'd say we're going towards and bringing in other partners where they have very unique insights on a market. We talked about the cloud computing and the Bessemer Venture Partners, where they're traditionally a venture capital firm, but they created an index to track this very particular segment of the cloud computing space. And there was competition in the market, but we thought their insights combined with a very unique portfolio, even though it was not the first to market, it was very differentiated from the market. And, so that combination where you could provide great education, great content, a diversified approach, that's always going to be our mantra is you can't be just me too. You have to add something valuable on top of the market. And whether it's index committee, active, for each fund, you're going to choose the right mix of things that lets you accomplish those goals.
Okay, so that's the perfect segue, because when you talk about unique insights on the markets and taking a differentiated approach, we're going to focus this week on one of WisdomTree's largest ETFs. It's also one that I feel like is really resonating with investors, because you look, this thing has grown from about $1 billion in assets to nearly $5 billion just over the past year, and that's the WisdomTree Emerging Markets Ex-State-Owned Enterprises ETF, ticker symbol XSOE. Walk through the basic idea behind this ETF. What's the overall investment goal? And then I have several other areas we can delve into.
Yeah, it's sort of like you get this overnight success, right? It's just one, overnight it turns into massive success. But no, it's been years in the making, 6-7 years. But it also shows you how difficult it is. I mean, you create a new idea, and this we created back in 2014, I want to say, and it sat at $2 million for years. And we had a point in our history where half of WisdomTree's assets were emerging markets assets, where we had a high dividend value fund, DEM, and we still have the world's largest emerging market small cap value fund, DGS. And so we had a lot of value tilts on the market, and people were looking at those portfolios. We'd be talking to clients, and one of those really smart institutional investors we were meeting with, a Texas pension fund, we've done some podcasts on this, but made a comment on, if you look at your top holdings, 8 of the top 10 holdings are either Chinese banks or Russian energy companies, Brazilian energy companies, materials companies. Have you thought about the influence of the state on these companies? And, what happens if you remove them? And that asking that question set us down this rabbit hole of looking for, how can you identify these companies? Are there any databases? There were not any databases to identify them. And, you can look at the top 10 and know who they are, but if you really did it in a cohesive way. And so our team set out to do the research, identify, create, what we think is the best database of companies who were state-owned. And then we started looking at, what happens when you remove them? And there was a consistent theme that it tended to be banks and energy are the two dominating sectors that are state-owned. It's not tech and healthcare and consumer. And so then you start going to portfolio construction. You're saying, all right, what are the tilts that are going to happen once you remove these? Well, at first, when we launched in 2014, you'd be out of China. Like, you'd be very, very underweight China. And that wasn't, you know, the intention. We think China could be one of the leading growth stories, particularly for their tech companies. And that has played out exactly as we thought. So we wanted to be market weight China, and not make these big country bets, but allow the state ownership factor to have its work. And so when we launched in the market, the state-owned companies were about 30% of the entire MSCI index, and for the leading China ETF, it was 75% to 80% of the leading China ETF in the market when we launched. And you know, that's gravitated over time just because how poorly state companies have performed for the last 7 years and how great the non-state companies have performed. So they've been gaining share. It's down to about 20% for the total market today. But I think, you know, my view is, And there's times when value will rotate. Like right now, the last 3 months, value is having a very strong comeback. And so the value funds are doing incredibly well. But if you say, I want ownership to EM for 10 years, why are you buying EM? It's because of their long-term growth prospects, demographics. You want those technology and consumer trends. And so a core fund that doesn't have big bets away from countries or massive, you know, bets on sectors, you're sort of slightly tilting the core to these factors that I think will deliver that long-term growth. That was the core story. It's resonating. And further, you know, the ESG drive you're seeing in portfolios, we've added additional ESG characteristics to enable it. It's won some ESG ETF of the Year awards in the past, and we think that trend is also helping find some new places for this portfolio.
Last I checked, this held stocks from, I believe, 18 emerging market countries. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, I mean, we try to be similar to MSCI's index. You know, there's going to be some at the margin where they're very, very small weights, and we didn't find it critical to this story, or that they weren't, maybe we even disagreed with MSCI's inclusion. But, you know, the major countries, we're benchmarking ourselves to MSCI. So, you know, as a starting point, you'll see our weights largely be similar to that broad index.
What exactly constitutes a state-owned enterprise? Like, what's the specific criteria?
Right. You know, this is that sort of question where there is, you know, quote unquote arbitrary, like what is the number you say where the government influences or not? We defined it as 20% ownership, but there's some other people who looked at it, put it at 50%. We thought we were being more conservative in a way, saying that if they own as much as 20%, they still have, you know, some influence on the companies. I think the first impression when you look at it, we've caught all the big ones that you would think of and know. And then the question is, below the line, are there companies that the government is influencing that you don't know? But I think as a very macro picture, I look at the Chinese banks as like symbolic of the state ownership. And when you think about, well, why is removing them important? Well, you know, during this pandemic, you know, basically the banks were being called upon to do national service and extend loans to all these state-oriented companies. And that's just common practice in China, that the state banks have to do this national service. And so the question is, it's not that they're running these banks just for the interest of shareholders. It's not like I could argue, did we try to nationalize Citi and Bank of America and all these other companies during our financial crisis in 2009? But that's a whole other issue. There's still more separate. There's truly way more separation, and you'd say we didn't really nationalize it. But they are fully entities of the state, and they're doing things beyond just the profit maximization of shareholders in these banks in China. And so I think that's one of the key places. But and so we define 20% as the magnitude. Now you could question, is really any company in China beyond the state influence? And that's a reasonable approach to take. But, you know, we do think that the tilts that we get in ours are symbolic with that bigger trend of really the banks, the energy companies, those are more like the state influenced. And sure, the tech and others are more in the spirit of the private enterprise.
You were mentioning earlier how there was no database out there to really identify the full list of companies that have state ownership. Can you talk more about that? Like, how much of a challenge is it to figure out which companies do have state ownership, and how readily available is that data?
Well, I can't give away all our secrets, but you had to assemble it. I mean, you have to basically go company by company. You have a team of analysts. Obviously, you're going to pull information from the publicly available sources that you can find, and it's a lot of different sources, from primary sources looking at individual company reports to databases that you have access to that talk about ownership holdings, cross-checking who are the state organizations that you believe, if they show up on the list, that they are part of the state. It's not like there's just one answer of where you find that information. So we do, you know, maintain that database and update it every year. So that it's not just like you can go to one place and get that piece of data.
You were alluding to this earlier, but I really want to try to crystallize this for listeners. If we were to take some of the most popular broad-based emerging market ETFs that are out there that, say, track the MSCI Emerging Markets Index or something like that, what is the underlying difference in composition? Like how much of the MSCI index is typically in state-owned enterprises? Just talk about some of the other major differences, sector composition. I really want to hammer this home.
And this is a great place to also emphasize what we do on our WisdomTree website. If you go to wisdomtree.com and there's a tool section, there's what's called index attribution. And we have a tab on index attribution that lets you actually pull down for state ownership attribution. And, you know, what you can do is you'll find, you know, since we launched, the SOE section of the MSCI index has averaged right around 25% of the MSCI index since we launched. Today, if you go last 1 year, it's down to 20%. So it's still 20% of a broad MSCI index that's still in state-owned companies. And that tool will let you see, you know, what's the average performance over different periods. I mean, I just clicked on it. For 3 years, the non-state-owned companies in MSCI have returned 9% a year. The state-owned companies have returned zero. So, I mean, that's averaged 23% of the MSCI index has returned zero, when the 77% has returned 9. I mean, you could see that's the influence that removing them has helped you avoid that zero. And actually, we've even had some stock selection benefits on top of the 9. But it's, you know, that tool will let you see the tail. We show it to you for really other indexes. If you want to look in China, you could get a sense of how much of it in China is, in India. It's really China's the big one, but, you know, there obviously are in other markets, and eventually we'll get this tool to be able to look at on a fund-by-fund basis as well. But for now, you could definitely see it on the index level there.
Jeremy, just a few minutes left. I want to make sure we touch on the overall case for emerging markets. And from my perspective, I mean, you look right now, there are a lot of terrible headlines coming out of India as it pertains to COVID, Latin America. Should that be a concern for investors? Because I've heard the case made that since the U.S. is pretty effectively deploying the vaccine right now, even though U.S. stocks might be on the higher end valuation-wise, right, and just from a relative perspective, emerging market stocks might be more attractive overall, a number of these emerging market countries are still in the throes of the pandemic. And so I think the thought is maybe the U.S. is still better positioned to continue outperforming, even though, again, that's been the case for the past decade plus. Any thoughts on that and any other potential positive drivers you might touch on for emerging markets?
Well, you know, India is certainly the poster child today of the pandemic running wild. I mean, on the other side of the coin is Taiwan, where they manage it incredibly well and had almost really no COVID. I mean, it's unbelievable the difference in Taiwan versus the rest of the world and in the U.S. and in India now. I think one of the lessons we learned from the U.S. was there was a huge drawdown in March as the pandemic came on, and then from the combined response everywhere, the markets rebounded very, very sharply. So like the panic selling that occurred with COVID here, people haven't really panic sold India, even though that the virus is raging, because, well, number one, I think one of the things we learned was the virus impacted old people way more than young people, and India, really young population. So, you know, I think in some ways there's this view that they can manage, and that they'll catch up, they'll get the vaccines eventually and get that under control, while also knowing that the markets are forward-looking, and even if they had a terrible 1 year for the economy and for profits, that they'll rebound sharply over time and still have one of the world's, you know, better demographic growth profiles over time. So I think there's two sides to that. I think the quick story is that EM does look cheaper versus the U.S., and the overall growth profile is high. I often say, you know, one of the reasons why the U.S. outperformed has been our sector mix. A lot of international is value tilted, and the U.S. is this tech growthy basket. And if you say who can actually compete with the U.S. tech giants, there's only one country who can, and that is China's tech giants. And that's where I think, whether it's CXSE, which is the China state-owned enterprises, or the broader one, the XSOE, which has the tilt to all those companies, that they are growing faster than the U.S. tech companies, and arguably have the data to continue to keep some of that edge. And so I think they can rival the U.S. even for that tech dominance there. So I think that's one thing to sort of counter that narrative there.
Well, and I think you could add to that just the rise of the Chinese consumer overall. I think could play a key role in terms of providing some fuel to that fire. But Jeremy, we're going to have to leave it there. Always enjoy connecting. Excellent perspective this week. Thank you.
Thanks, Nate.
That was Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree.